Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is I'll Burn That Bridge When I Get to It, an evening with Norman Finkelstein and Brianna Joy Gray, featuring heretical thoughts on identity politics, cancel culture, and academic freedom. America's most canceled intellectual presents a scorching defense of free thought and a devastating indictment of a left that has lost its way. Norman Finkelstein is an American political scientist and activist whose primary fields of research are the politics of the Holocaust and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Finkelstein was born in New York City to Jewish Holocaust survivor parents. Brianna Joy Gray is an American political commentator, lawyer, and political consultant. Norman Finkelstein and Brianna Joy Gray spoke on May 8, 2025 at the Francis Kite Club in New York City, which is also the home of book publisher Or Books. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
What an enormous pleasure and honor it is to be here with Norman Finkelstein. I am not exaggerating. There is no hyperbole when I say I can't think of anyone who I enjoy interviewing more, dialoguing more with, whose intellect and rigor I respect more. And it's such an honor to be able to be in the space with him. I want to say as an anecdote, Norm, I was in New York last week and I came in from DC today. And my friends and I was visiting some law school friends. We were debating, as friends do when we get together, the finer points of the Gaza genocide. And the cab driver turns around and goes, you know who you should really listen to on this is Norm Finkelstein. And I say, fact, if you want, you should come downtown in a few days, and I'll be interviewing him on exactly that. So you are infamous and so broadly respected, and you give a voice to so many who find themselves overwhelmed by the overwhelming gist of mainstream dialogue on this issue. So I just want to say thank you right off the bat.
Well, thank you. And it really is my pleasure to be on with Brianna. I have just a whole lot of respect, not just for her intellect and her personality, though I do appreciate that she laughs at my jokes. But it took a very special toughness this past year for Brianna to assume the role that she did, because it was, for those of you who watched her program Rising, it was day after day, Brianna would not relent. And it was plain as day to anybody watching it that at some point something had to break. This could not go on. Her co-host, you can almost see him at a certain point imploding and just begging and pleading, please stop. Please, Brianna, stop this. Brianna, you are destroying this program. You have become a verbal pyromaniac. And Brianna is Black and she is a woman. And it was not easy for her, in my opinion, it was not easy for her to just relentlessly and you might say ruthlessly attack Israel and what Israel was doing. And as I said, it really did take a special kind of courage. And Brianna is smart enough to know, as she told me later, that this could not last. I knew that I was, to quote the title of a book, I knew I was burning that bridge. And she persisted. It was very impressive. Actually, the three best programs over the past year were by women, It was Breonna Joy Gray, it was Katie Hopper, and it was Crystal Bull, all three of whom were relentless, courageous, really impressive. So, and Breonna's just very smart, so it's always a pleasure, though she can be contrarian.
Me? Norman Finkelstein saying that I'm contrarian. I need to talk about this with my therapist.
I think at the end of every program I'm on with her, I think, why did she have to do that?
Well, we're both a little bit dogs with a bone, so we'll see where this takes us this evening. One area where we very much agree, and we've had a lot of simpatico over the years, is in our critiques of identity politics. From my perspective, I tend to characterize it as the weaponization of identity politics as opposed to just the identity politics themselves, because of course you can define identity politics as simply having a concern about the discrete issues that are germane to a given identity group, that are real and legitimate and material, and advocacy to reform whatever those problems are on the basis of those identities, of course, is not a problem in and of itself. The problem is the way that it is weaponized and twisted by something like the Democratic Party in order to disguise the lack of substantive material offerings they have for those discrete groups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That being said, there's been interesting ways in which this current political moment, both because we're in the second Trump term and also because we're in this bipartisan, very pro-Zionist environment, that identity politics has been validated in some ways and undermined in other ways. So a trend tweet that you might have seen is something along the lines of conservatives, people who are critiquing identity politics, generally speaking, across the political spectrum, saying, I miss woke because the Department of Education gets to fund it, or I'll take woke over Trump's tariff regime that threw the stock market into a spin. You'll have people who are elites who are so mad about their stock portfolios that they'll say, oh gosh, I miss wokeness, right? And on the other side, you have this illustration of the failures of wokeness, the negative aspects of wokeness, when you see the exact same arguments instrumentalized in favor of Zionism. And I wonder how you've perhaps thought differently about your critiques of wokeness now that we're in a very different political environment from the sort of Obama era in which a lot of these concerns arose.
Well, to begin with, I'll state the obvious, that whole woke phenomenon has suffered a major blow, perhaps even a lethal blow, since the election of President Trump. The Democratic Party thought it had a vehicle that would bring them into the White House, namely this hyper focus on the wokeness. There was a period where it was just hard to even believe what you were reading in the New York Times with the support they were lending to, for example, the George Floyd demonstrations, even giving some support to the toppling of the statues at the end of the George Floyd phenomenon. And that's over. A realization has set in that vehicle, namely the woke politics and the identity politics, that vehicle has reached an impasse. It's not going to succeed. So how do I feel about it? I guess I'll try to be concrete rather than abstract. I'll make some basic observations. It was very interesting to watch what happened in the spring of this a year ago now, almost exactly a year ago now, because you had not one, not two, but you had three Ivy League presidents toppled by the Jewish supremacist billionaire class. It began with Mr. Ackman at Harvard. And it turns out I had just read, and we're going to get to it later, I just read the Harvard Task Force reports. And in the one on anti-Semitism, it mentioned that two of the first critics of Claudine Gay, they had each, or I should say respectively, one had given $200 million to Harvard. The second had given $300 million to Harvard. And by that standard, even Bill Ackman, who led the attack at Harvard, he had given only a mere $50 million. Now, why do I bring it up? Because we were in the era of wokeness at that point. Claudine Gay was a black woman. At the U of P, it was President McGill who was a woman. And then at Columbia, it was President Shafiq, who also was, as the expression has it, a woman of color. And their woke bona fides did not save them. They were all toppled very quickly, and there wasn't a peep of dissent or defense of them by the Democratic Party, by its outlets like the New York Times and the New Yorker magazine. They were dead and gone. And that to me was very revealing about just how committed these institutions actually were to the woke agenda when push came to shove. When push came to shove, Ms. Gay, Ms. McGill, and Ms. Shafiq Hout were thrown under the bus. In terms of the current situation, I would say the following. In my opinion, and here Brianna and I obviously can disagree, I do believe that there was a serious problem with wokeness in higher education. There was a serious lack of tolerance of dissenting points of view in certain disciplines. There was, in my opinion, a profound distortion of certain disciplines, a watering down of those disciplines, which above and beyond all else was a profound disservice to the students. They were being fed, if I could say it, they were being fed garbage in the classroom. There was this woke apparatchik attitude, and students, apart from the handful of social justice warriors, were not happy with what was going on in the classroom. So it began in the spring with the Jewish supremacist billionaire class going after the encampments. Let's never forget that did not happen under Trump. That happened under Biden. for those who have a memory that reaches back a year, the threats of deportation began under the Biden administration. The suspensions, the expulsions, all of that was under the Biden administration. However, it's also true that the Trump administration, while still actively pursuing the totally bogus war on anti-Semitism on college campuses, and that's still the core of it, is being promoted by the Jewish supremacist, the billionaire class. It's true, he expanded the target. It's now not just anti-Semitism, he's expanded the target to all those woke courses, woke so-called disciplines, which are not only authoritarian, but they are intellectually vacuous. They have no intellectual content whatsoever. They are buzzwords and slogans devoid of intellectual content. So he went after that because it wasn't difficult. There was a lot of dissatisfaction on the college campus with those classes, those courses, those so-called reading lists that were being provided. So, in my view, there was a real problem. But I do not accept that it's the Trump administration that should be breaching the basic principles of academic freedom as they pretend to solve the problem. Just as a simple piece of education, academic freedom means fundamentally one thing. Fundamentally, it means that only your professional peers are qualified or competent to judge your qualifications and your competence. It began as a principle to rid the universities of the influence of religion, because it began in Germany. Germans were establishing what they called research institutes, which were pursuing truth, pursuing science, and religion was a constraint on that pursuit. So first, we want to get religion out of the university. In our country, at the beginning of the 20th century, the second challenge came from not the billionaire class, but from the class that was called back then the robber barons. And the robber barons did not like that a small handful of faculty were sympathetic to the incipient, the burgeoning workers' movement. So we want to get the capitalist class out of the university so we can pursue truth. And then came the McCarthy era, where it was the state that wanted to limit speech. So I do believe, even as I was not a beneficiary of academic freedom, I was not. I am 71 years old, and I never had a job. That's not a joke. I never had a job. I was what you call an adjunct, which means you get paid sub-minimum wage to teach classes which were always overflowing. However, even as I was not a beneficiary of academic freedom, I still strongly believe the basic principle. If you want to teach physics, it should not be J.D. Vance who decides your qualifications. Same with biology, chemistry, and same in the humanities. So the dilemma became the wokeness had infected a large part of academia. Academia was not doing the housekeeping that it should have done. And then it enabled the Trump administration to intervene, but I absolutely oppose it. It has to be an internal process, and there has to be a serious reckoning with this disaster that has set in the past decade or so, this utterly empty, vacuous content. And a large part of what I wrote in the book is simply to go through the iconic texts to demonstrate there is just nothing there.
I think that what makes this issue slightly complicated for someone, especially in the context of not only the arguments that right figures like J.D. Vance and Donald Trump are making about what's being taught on campuses, but also the kind of arguments that are being deployed in the sort of Harvard Task Force letter context, that there's some parallels there, and they're all taking aims at a certain kind of academic lens that has been described as woke. And I'm not talking about, Ibram X. Kendi. I'm talking about, I think, more substantive academic lanes, like what they call like the oppressed framework. Every time you turn on the TV and hear a conservative commentator bemoaning woke, so often they'll say, these pro-Palestine students, they see everything in terms of oppressed and oppressor, and therefore you can't take anything that they say seriously. CRT, we all got a crash course on critical race theory, or didn't actually, but we were told that it was this boogeyman that was the predecessor to woke. And there were all these things that were promulgated in an HR context that were like, timeliness is white culture and expecting people to show up on time. And that sort of is easily parodied and absurd, right? But there's also real substantive scholarship. That is CRT, the real CRT, I would argue, in a critical legal studies framework. And the fact that not only are these right-wing advocates taking aim at the idea that there are power dynamics in the world and that colonialism is a thing and a lens that you should use to evaluate various circumstances, and also in the Harvard Task Force, I don't know if you noted that, they specifically take aim at the fact that some of the polarization on campus is a consequence of students adopting that framework for looking at the world and therefore seeing, yes, the occupation of Palestine is a big problem, is something that they need to have more academic neutrality in both sides-erism around. So do you have any concern? I think for me, at least, the concern is validating a framing that would lump in what I think are constructive frameworks for evaluating the world, including Palestine, with some of the absurdity, which, again, I think was mostly, not that it was never raised its head in academic circumstances, but was largely a bastardization of like academic ideas in an HR context, that by conflating all of these things, you're kind of paving the way for venom against woke that is really more pernicious. It's venom against an academic philosophical lens that allows you to describe power dynamics and imbalances in the world.
Okay, first of all, just some background, because we can't assume everybody knows the references we're making. there was a Harvard task force on two issues. One was on anti-Semitism, what it called anti-Semitism and anti-Israel bias. And then there was a second task force on anti-Arab, anti-Islam, and anti-Palestinian sentiment at Harvard campus. And each of those task forces, there were two of them, issued their reports about last week. The one on anti-Semitism and anti-Israel bias ran to about 311 pages. The one on anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, anti-Palestinian bias ran to 220 pages. I would say the one on anti-Semitism should have been entitled the Harvard Task Force on Jewish Naval Contemplation. By the end of the report, I have to say, with all due respect to Brianna and her alma mater, I didn't give a flying fig how anybody felt at Harvard about anything. You feel unwanted, you feel unsafe, you feel this and you feel that. I mean, if you read the Harvard Task Force on Anti-Semitism, I'm really surprised they didn't go to the International Court of Justice and charge genocide for what they had to endure or what they claim they had to endure. Now, having said that, to the specific questions that Brianna brought up. Number one, this kind of wokeism at Harvard was very fringe. They never really talk much about the Harvard Faculty of Arts and Sciences. It's these fringe aspects. For most of you probably know, higher education now is a business. And so as a business, they create all of these continuing education, general education, all of these satellites which are taught. Actually, the whole thing began at NYU, because NYU was always a business, or at least when it was taken over in the 1990s, it became just a business operation. I used to call it NYU-NY, like DKNY. It was just a brand. And they started to create all these spin-offs, and it was a wonderful idea, because if we'll take Harvard now, Harvard, students get to say they studied at Harvard. They didn't study at Harvard. They studied at one of these silly, flaky satellite campuses.
When it's like the Olsen twins got a degree from Harvard, yeah. Or I think Tyra Banks got one too. That's what it is. No shade.
Yeah. And Harvard was making a mint off of its brand, because all the students want to be able to say, I got my degree at Harvard. And the adjuncts, like myself, were paid slave wages to teach in these programs. No exaggeration, in the 1990s, to teach a course there, you got $1,500. $1,500 to teach a course.
For a semester?
Yeah, for a semester, yeah. It was lower paid than even CUNY.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is I'll Burn That Bridge When I Get to It, an evening with Norman Finkelstein and Brianna Joy Gray, featuring heretical thoughts on identity politics, cancel culture, and academic freedom.
In any event, so most of the wokeness was confined to like one program that the task force talks about. It's called Religion and Public Life, RPL. It's a division of the Harvard Divinity School. I hope there's nobody here who got a degree from there and is going to be peeved at me. But it was plainly unserious. And then there was a couple of programs at the Harvard School of Public Health, which came under attack. when you read the descriptions of what went on in the classroom, it was really woke. We're going to de-Zionize the Jewish mind. We're going to decolonize. You know, it was like just crap. So I'm not going to defend any of that, but I don't think it was representative of anything.
And in fact,
and it was also, by the way, it was these courses were all taught by what are called, quote, non-ladder faculty. What non-ladder faculty means is you're not in a tenure-track job. You're just a loser with a PhD, and you're looking to teach anywhere, which was what I was. If I were in Cambridge, I probably would have taught in one of those flaky satellites. So when I was reading it, I said, uh-oh, this does sound like wokeness. I don't like that syllabus. I don't like the intolerance. I don't like the authoritarianness, so I'm not prepared to defend it, but I don't think it was a significant phenomenon. But there was one thing that was very noticeable. Very noticeable. And here, I'm going to toot my own horn in the to paraphrase Hillel, if I don't toot my horn, who will? Isn't that what Hillel said? Something like that. So, one of the hallmarks of the wokeness was they did not like the idea of freedom of speech. They didn't think it was a good idea. You know, they came up with all of these highfalutin theories about speech acts, and they quote Derrida and Lacan and who the hell else, and who the hell cares. And so they wanted to replace the principle of free speech. They wanted to substitute for it a new formula that you can stifle and suppress speech if you, meaning a particular oppressed group, you felt unwelcome, unsafe, or uncomfortable. That was the standard. Forget free speech. We're going to set up a new woke standard. Oppressed groups have the right to suppress speech which causes them to feel unwelcome, unsafe, or uncomfortable. Now, it happens for those of you who have purchased a copy of the book hot off the press, on page 37, I say directly to Palestinians and their supporters, I say, folks, don't go down that path because it's very predictable what's going to happen. You say that Israeli speaker makes me feel unsafe, unwelcome, and uncomfortable, and therefore he or she should not have the right to speak. And I said in the book, it's only a matter of time before the other side says, we don't want any Palestinian speakers because they make us Jews feel unsafe, unwelcome, and uncomfortable. And now, if you open up the Harvard Task Force report on anti-Semitism, every other page, Jewish students feel unsafe, uncomfortable, and unwelcome. And that's why there's a problem of anti-Semitism at Harvard, because of how Jewish students feel. They appropriated all the woke language and then weaponized it in order to crush the dissents on Harvard campus, but elsewhere as well. It was an easily predictable disaster in the making. The left has historically fought for expanding to the maximum the boundaries of free speech. That's a hallmark of the left tradition. And that tradition was traduced by this woke culture, which replaced free speech with our hurt feelings.
So Norm, I'm glad we landed here, because I think this is the crux of my ambivalence. Abstractly, in a lot of contexts, the left talks about the importance of defending speech rights. We reference the KKK walking through a community of Holocaust survivors and having to defend their right to do so, because eventually they'll come for us and we need it to be tit for tat. But in practice, devil's advocate, what we're seeing play out as it's played out on these college campuses is that there might be these rhetorical opportunities and sort of a political openness to a kind of woke left post-Obama sort of pro-diversity influence. And you'll get someone like Roxane Gay after 400-odd years of Harvard's existence becoming the first Black president, dean of the university. She lasted 6 months and was immediately toppled because power spoke more than principle. And my experience—
Just for clarity, Roxane Gay?
Sorry, Claudine Gay. Yeah. I do that every time. Roxane Gay is a journalist who's her cousin.
I know.
And I have a weird brain tick about that. I'm so sorry. Yeah. Claudine Gay. And my experience in school during, I guess, the woke era— I mean, I haven't been in college for like 20 years, but my experience in school was that while I think there was, we were in a liberal, well, it was like the Bush era, but we were in an increasingly liberal moment in terms of what was socially accepted, and it certainly wasn't what we're experiencing now when Republicans are trying to rebrand Martin Luther King as bad, actually. You know, it felt like a more progressive time, even though it was the Bush era. As much as, or I was in law school during the Obama era, it felt like while culturally there were some victories, institutionally it was very conservative. And while some conservative might feel like their views weren't validated in the classroom, and the task force memo kind of acknowledges this, the university structurally and the opportunities professionally outside of the universities all mitigate in favor of the more conservative student. Whereas the benefits, the cultural benefits, the community benefits of adopting a more woke approach to life only exist within the confines of the university and specific departments. And most of the activism coming out of those woke communities is applied on campus. So protesting wages of university staff, those kinds of things, and was very rarely directed into the real world. That's all to say the power of the woke was purely rhetorical and very limited, was representational a la Claudine Gay becoming president, and was ultimately short-lived, because the second the real money and power spoke in the context of the Bill Ackmans of the world, we saw how superficial it all was. So similarly, in the task force, they also talk about, you know, you said, well, at the very least, we have these academic principles where you're academic merit should be vetted by your peers, and we should stand by that principle, and that should put some guardrails on this whole thing. Well, the task force also contemplates having more restrictions on who actually gets staffed and viewpoint diversity on the people in the Arab Studies Department, the implication being that everyone in the Arab Studies Department is like Israel is an occupier and is in the wrong. Therefore, we got to hire some new folks so we have viewpoint diversity. So you're going to get to a place, arguably, where your peers are being pre-selected for having views that aren't necessarily academically validated, but are politically validated. And so at every turn, it does seem at the end of the day, as much as we can and should stand by these generic principles or broader principles, How do you deal with the fact that in practice, all of the kind of complaining about the woke was about a couple of college kids with blue hair who might have said some crazy things, whereas on the other side, you have presidents and vice presidents actually stripping funding from universities. You have students being deported. You have tenured professors being kicked out of school. And on, you have this Columbia student that was wrestled down and brutalized by campus police yesterday. How do we make these arguments in the realm of principle when the reality of the power dynamics seem to suggest that the principle of the thing is insufficient to protect our rights?
Look, I said I did not benefit from those guardrails. So it's kind of paradoxical that I would now be supporting the system of what's called academic freedom. 9 times out of 10, we are going to lose because the system is rigged against those who vigorously dissent from the dogmas of those who control the system. However, it's a question of, if you're a person of the left, you're trying to reach a broad public and you're trying to make a plausible, credible case so that in some instances, just a few, I acknowledge, you actually have the possibility of winning. So I said, Brianna's totally correct. I mean, the heart of these institutions, there was very little wokeness except for, you know, a black face instead of a white face, a female face instead of a male face. Yes, in the core of these institutions, you know, they let these people in Complet or a lot of these other majors. They were able to seize power in these majors and produce a vast accumulation of gobbledygook. There was a time when in my free hours at night, I watched British murder mysteries. Now, when I have run out of them, I watch Judith Butler lectures just to amuse myself. Trying to mentally unwind before bedtime. However, having said and granted everything Brianna just said, I still believe you could have made, or we could have made, a more credible case in the spring and now. If we had simply said, let me give you, I try always to be concrete. As I told one of my students who's here this evening, I said, you have to always go from the abstract to the concrete or you lose your audience. So let's take a concrete example. That infamous slogan, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Personally, I don't like the slogan, but that's totally irrelevant to the issue at hand. The slogan was first denounced at Harvard by none other than Claudine Gay, the woke president of Harvard. She was the first one to denounce it. What should have been the response? Listen closely, in my opinion. I'm asking you to listen closely. I'm not ordering you to listen closely. Our country has a very impressive, and I'm not a flag waver, and right now my parents would probably be filled with revulsion at what I'm saying. Our country has a very impressive record on the books when it comes to free speech. So listen, in our country, the Supreme Court has ruled you have the right to advocate the violent overthrow of your government. You have that right to advocate the violent overthrow of our government. I know that to be true because in my Maoist youth, I was advocating the violent overthrow of the government every day of every week, of every month, of every year in our newspaper, The Guardian. And guess what? Are you ready for this? It never even crossed my mind that I would be arrested. It was just taken. We understood we had that right. In our country, we have the right to burn the American flag. That case came before the court in 1989. It's a very interesting case to read because the dissent in the case was written by the Chief Justice Rehnquist. And he wrote this very long dissent, and he said, it's our flag. It's our flag. And he talked about Francis Scott Key. I'm serious. He then recited a poem by this woman named Barbara Fritzky. It was two pages in his dissent. And he was obviously, and I can get it because I feel the same way about the red flag. He said, they raised the flag at Iwo Jima. They marched into battle carrying that flag. And now he says to the majority on the court, you're saying they have the right to desecrate it. And the court said, yes, that's what we're saying. It's symbolic speech. It's expressive conduct. It's protected in our Constitution, the First Amendment. And then there was the series of rulings in the case of Skokie, Illinois. 70,000 people lived in that community. 40,000 were Jewish, and a small but significant number in the hundreds were Holocaust survivors, survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. And along comes the Nazi Party, which it's forgotten, is also legal in our country, just as the Ku Klux Klan is legal in our country. You may not like it, but that's our country's tradition, history, jurisprudence. And along comes the American Nazi Party, and it says it wants to march through Skokie. And as you can imagine, the Jewish community felt very uncomfortable, very uncomfortable, unwelcome with the Nazis marching through it. Now, that case went through three court hearings, the Eastern District Court, the Illinois Supreme Court, and not only did they find that the Nazi Party had the right to march, they found that the Nazi Party had the right to wear its military regalia. And then it went to the Illinois Supreme Court, and they ruled the Nazi Party had the right to wear the swastika. And they said, the bedrock principle of our First Amendment jurisprudence is you cannot suppress speech that offends. You cannot suppress speech that is offensive. Now, had that history been recited in the spring, any observer would have said, well, if we as Americans have the right to advocate the violent overthrow of the government, if Nazis can march through Skokie, if anti-Republicans have the right to burn the American flag, then from the river to the sea is small change. It's nothing. You may like or you may not like the slogan, but in terms of our own constitutional history, our jurisprudence, it's nothing. And that would have been, I'm not saying we would have won.
And in fact, we didn't, right?
Allow me to complete the thought and then you have the stage. We didn't win because we lost the language. We lost the language. We had been using the standard of unwelcome, unsafe, and uncomfortable. And they ran with that language. We had used the language of free speech and say, hey guys, do you know what our Supreme Court has ruled? Just to give you an example, when Professor Shafiq was at the congressional hearing, not Professor, President Shafiq from Columbia, when she was at the congressional hearing, somebody commented afterwards, and it really struck me. Somebody commented, you know what were the two words you never heard President Shafiq say? The two words? She never said academic freedom. She never uttered it. She could have said to Stefanik, Ms. Stefanik, you attended Harvard. You don't know what our Supreme Court has ruled?
But why do you think Shafiq and none of the others made those kinds of arguments? We were referring to them as woke on the basis basically of their identity. And I have some issue with that conflation because all of those presidents ultimately weren't woke at all in terms of actually advocating for Palestinian interests, even standing up for basic constitutional principles. They all sounded insane during those hearings and like marble-mouthed, you know, nothings. Certainly not esteemed professors who I'm sure are very intelligent to get to where they, were very intelligent to get to where they are, because I would argue they were concerned about the donor base and not saying anything that would be offensive to them. And so when you're making bad arguments, and as an intelligent person, the same way that I often argue about the Democratic Party, at a certain point you have to open yourself to the possibility that they're losing because those good arguments aren't available to them, because they're being directed by something other than their intellect or what they know is correct legally or any other kind of moral or intellectual framework. So what do you do with that? And does it benefit us to lean into the characterization of these people who are ultimately tools of the moneyed interests that we're so critical of the left as woke simply because they are minority women or just women? are we in some ways participating in that fiction and doing a sort of, you know, racecraft of our own by adopting that terminology?
Well, I agree with Brianna that these folks, part of the reason they didn't use the language of free speech is because, A, they were never committed to defending the rights of students to defending the anti-genocide encampments. I agree with that. I also agree with Brianna that the main factor at that point was the donor issue. The Jewish supremacists, the billionaires. It's very striking that when you read the two reports on anti-Semitism and anti-Israel bias, and then you read the report on anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, anti-Palestinian bias. When you read the two reports, the first report makes a half-sentence mention of the billionaires who gave $200 and $300 million to Harvard, and then not another word about that. In 311 pages, not another word. When you read the other report by the anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, anti-Palestinians, every other page, those donors, they are dictating what's happening on our college campuses. So I agree with what you say. Don't have expectations of these presidents. Ultimately, they are responsive to their donors, because the main job of a college president is fundraising. That's not a joke, that's a fact. They are hired to fundraise. That's their job description. And secondly, hey, they like the system. They're beneficiaries of it. Here are these women of color who are now leading our major institutions. I'm talking about us, the left, what, in my opinion, we should have been saying to bring to light, which I suspect comes as a surprise even to people in this room. Because when I say things like, you know, our Supreme Court has had this issue about advocating the violent overthrow of the government, and it's been an issue for the court since the early 1900s, when the anarchists and the communists, a lot of them foreign-born, you know, people like Emma Goldman, came over here with this issue: do you have the right to advocate the violent overthrow of the government? A lot of people nowadays have no idea about that. They're completely shocked.
But Nora.
And I think we have a real responsibility to retrieve that tradition, and also to rid ourselves of a vocabulary, a political vocabulary, which has proven to be a complete and total disaster.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was I'll Burn That Bridge When I Get to It, an evening with Norman Finkelstein and Brianna Joy Gray, featuring heretical thoughts on identity politics, cancel culture, and academic freedom. Norman Finkelstein is an American political scientist and activist whose primary fields of research are the politics of the Holocaust and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Finkelstein was born in New York City to Jewish Holocaust survivor parents. Brianna Joy Gray is an American political commentator, lawyer, and political consultant. Norman Finkelstein and Brianna Joy Gray spoke on May 8, 2025 at the Francis Kite Club in New York City, which is also the home of book publisher Or Books. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.